prominent building. There also are some three-story apartment buildings. And a reminder that in the R2 zone, which is what surrounds it, your maximum height is 40 feet.
So what are the heights in question as to whether this should be one or two?
So the question is whether or not we want three-story buildings with a maximum height of up to 40 feet with a 5-foot ground floor, or if we want 45 feet, potentially up to 50. So 40 and 50 is what's that question. So Joan's going to come up. We're going to shift to the west side of the river now.
Everyone, Joan Fredrickson, good morning, West District Liaison. Can you show your PowerPoint? Thanks. So this first area that we're looking at here along Southwest Hamilton is just on the south side of Barber Boulevard coming out of the Central City. And these are some properties that are currently developed with single-family homes and have requested through the comprehensive plan process requested to be zoned, to be designated commercial. So we went ahead and designated them mixed use civic corridor, I believe, here. And they have we initially and PSC upheld the idea that we would wait on the zoning here and retain the residential because they had existing houses and because we were knowing that the Southwest Corridor plan was going to be coming in and doing probably additional work around the station areas. We thought that it would be better to retain them, but we have heard testimony asking for the change to commercial zoning at this juncture.
Related to the Southwest Corridor, I think many of you are aware that since the PSC made its initial recommendation, we're now heading into the DEIS process with the proposed light rail line on in this location. So we're a little bit further along, but still not to the final.
And the next one is there are similar to the RH conversation that we had earlier. There were some changes also in the Alphabet Historic District proposed for going from CM3 to CM2. And that was testimony that came in during the PSC phase, and the PSC supported a step down for the eastern edge of the historic district for some properties to go instead of going to CM3 because they have EX today, instead of going to CM3 to take them down to CM2. And so staff worked on coming up with a proposal that the PSC supported, which was to take about 3 or 4 blocks considering the contributing structures that were located there and creating a step down transition from the band of EX that's adjacent to I-405 and the historic district. So that's the proposed, that's the recommended draft today.
And just one way to read this map is that the red color is the existing and proposed EX or CM3, and then the orange is, you know, specifically where there's the recommendation to step down to CM2. There is one property that's non-conforming, which is just north of the Northwest Community Center that's included in this surface parking lot.
Okay. And then we just have some images of the area. Most of us are familiar with it. Any questions on that? The next area is an area of also in the Northwest Plan District area, and it's in the northern section along Thurman and between Thurman and Vaughan. And I'm not quite sure what the questions are here, but the PSC recommended a change to CM1 for some pockets along Northwest Thurman to maintain the smaller scale commercial and residential along Thurman, because it's not a huge corridor, and that is conforms with the policy that came out of the Northwest Plan District as well. Initially, we had proposed CM2 for the whole corridor, but PSC supports the change to having sort of a nodal CM2, CM1 pattern along Thurman.
And we did, the reason it's on this list is we did get some testimony from property owners in opposition to that.
And specifically, the star on the map is just acknowledging the intersection of 26th and Upshur.
So there's the Thurman corridor, and then there was piece of testimony from a property owner at 26th and Upshur, and they requested to be designated CM2 instead of CM1. So we've just highlighted that area there. That may be an appropriate place because it's a through street in that section. Not all the three streets go through, but in that case it does. And it's a large site.
And the image on the lower left is the image of the property in question.
Partly, yeah, there's like a one-story or one-and-a-half-story warehouse building, and then the balance of the site is parking.
The next map is the overview of the Multnomah Village mixed-use designations, and we felt like we needed to show you this one more time because of the volume of testimony we got. Just a reminder, the PSC did recommend a smaller-scale CM1 zone in the core of the Multnomah Village, which is that pink area in the middle of the map that corresponds to the area with the smaller lots and the more vintage storefronts. The rest of the village retains its CM2 with the exception of some of the edges, which go back to CM1. We got a lot of testimony asking that the whole village be CM1. And so that's the question at hand.
And then the hatching on the map is representative of the existing design overlay currently in the village.
So on this, and also didn't we start off with a dozen or so requests for CM1 in, you know, commercial storefront areas, and we wound up with three: Selwood, Belmont, and Multnomah.
Yeah, this was triggered by your discussion, your policy discussion in the spring about better linking the zoning, the base zoning, with historic preservation, and this was one manifestation of that. And we did some work going into the Planning Commission to identify some candidate areas where there was a predominance of the older storefront buildings that could potentially qualify for historic status if we were proceeding with our renewed program to do new inventories. And there were about 12 different areas throughout the city. The PSC had quite a bit of debate about that, and there was a mix of neighborhood opposition to some, neighborhood support for others, a lot of site-specific factors, and the PSC used an evaluation criteria that they came up with to filter those, and out of the end came three that they thought were good candidates to retain that lower density. But on the whole, they recommended sticking with the higher CM2 zoning in many of those areas.
So, I mean, what do you think? There's a couple of issues. One, these are like really small segments, and in at least some cases, I think the property owners are saying, wait a minute, you're singling me out because you're only addressing a few properties. The broader question, though, is that, I mean, are we losing the potential for housing in some of our best neighborhoods? And should we be making that decision based on, you know, the views of those people who happen to have testified in these neighborhoods as opposed to others?
The ones that are left on the table generally had more support. That was one of the criterias for this discussion. So we ended up with a section of 13th and Selwood, Belmont, at 35th and 37th, and then and Multnomah, and all of those generally shared the characteristic that they had neighborhood support and a general lack of opposition, although there was some from the business community. So that was part of the process. In terms of the housing impact, because there's only three sites and it's fairly small areas, it doesn't have a significant impact on our overall housing supply. All of these corridors have CM2 and other zoning in the close proximity that would allow quite a bit of development. And I think the neighborhood's feeling that preservation of some of these core commercial areas is a priority of theirs, and it doesn't necessarily detract from the residential development. It's one of the reasons there is so much residential development there is that these amenities are valued.
But we also heard and had long conversations at the PSC among the members that these were the most vocal places. They were central inner neighborhoods where people had the time to come and be able to be heard. And so as you make this decision, I think that's a part of the decision making is, are we excluding a couple of few areas because people really came out and made the case, because there may be some other areas in the city that weren't as well represented. Most of these areas, though, in a way, are sort of all 12 that we picked could be considered, you know, not historic areas, but they've been there a long time, and they have some, you know, cultural significance to the neighborhood. That's how they ended up on the list in the first place.
Just can't resist saying that sort of sounds like the difference between observantly Jewish and culturally Jewish, like me. They say these are culturally historic, although not observantly historic.
Okay, if there aren't any more questions on the mixed-use portion of the map, we're going to transition to residential.
Actually, I did have one question. I don't think we had examples of these listed on the PowerPoint, but we have had some requests from property owners seeking CM3 zoning, a parcel that's zoned CM2. And I think there's a fair number of examples of areas where the designation is CM3, but we have the zoning is CM2. And I just wanted discussion about why that is, and I think a fair number of cases, and what's the rationale.
Right. The best example of that is many of the inner southeast corridors are zoned CM2, while the comp plan is an urban center, which hypothetically could allow on a case-by-case basis CM3. And we, partly for you know, workload and being able to finish the project reasons, we chose not to take on wholesale rezoning of areas that are qualified for higher density. We limited it to more strategic locations. And so there are quite a few centers and corridors where one could ask for the CM3 in the future. We did not immediately go and put that on the ground, partly because we didn't have the time to have all those local involvement processes to discuss every one of those situations. So an example is you're going to have, I think you got testimony from the Plaid Pantry on 12th and Belmont, where there's CM2 proposed and recommended, but it hypothetically could be CM3 in the future. In many of those cases, we did not recommend that immediate change because there just needs to be more discussion about those particular areas with a little bit more public involvement at the local level.
Could you just remind me what is the process for requesting a specific zone change?
Well, if you have a comp plan designation of urban center, you're allowed to request CM3 through a quasi-judicial application if you don't already have CM3. And that's a BDS zone change application, basically.
How long do those usually take?
Roughly about 103 days, 3.5 months.
Yeah, and it's, I forget the application fee right now, but it's a...
it's about $18,000 in this case.
And typically you have to look at service availability is the primary criteria, but with the new comp plan, there's also a question of what the appropriate zone is. So in the case of many inner neighborhoods that are surrounding residential areas, you would have to look at CM3 is intended for areas that are major transit corridors and station areas and where you're not immediately abutting single family. So they'd have to look at, is the site a narrow corridor that's surrounded by single family, or is it in a larger context of multifamily that already has larger buildings?
And one other follow-up to the CM3, Eric was mostly responding on the individual basis, but with the new urban framework structure in the mixed-use urban center and the mixed-use civic corridor designations, it does give the ability to staff to have a legislative area planning process to do further study, analysis, and community conversation if there was a corridor. Okay, we're going to switch to residential and open space, and unless there's no more. Okay.
We only got a few of those.
Mm-hmm. So just a step back on the residential zones. I just wanted to give some kind of overall numbers just to kind of set the context. So specifically on the zoning map, which is before you, this is a zoning map that shows in color the areas that are changes to residential zones and changes to open space. And so you can see that it's a pretty small area. And specifically, the acreage is 3,793 acres, or 10% of the city, that are proposed with zone changes to residential or open space designations. Of those changes on the residential, there are what we call up zones, so areas where increased density can occur, on 978 acres. So of the proposed changes, that is 26%. On the down zones, there are 2,814 acres, so 74% of the changes. And so I just, again, I think that's a really important context to make. We did incredible analysis in, the hills and the where there's stormwater challenges and where we have really difficult emergency response times. And I would say that that really is the bulk of the down zoning that's proposed. And then the up zones are really, for the most part, because there were non-conforming residential densities, so existing non-conforming residential densities on the ground, or specifically where there was 1980 comprehensive plan map designation where there was a mismatch. And we, the district liaison team, has spent the last year doing a pretty thorough analysis, and we held in the first round over 15 neighborhood meetings, speaking directly to the folks that we were doing analysis within their community. Some other areas.
That's really a very interesting comparison of the upzoning versus downzoning. Where did we end up into a number of total number of units, either plus or minus?
The total is still plus, in part because of the changes in the mixed-use zones, but the total new comp plan has more than the old.
And do we have a number for that?
Yeah, I don't have it on any piece of paper in front of me, but I could get that.
Yeah. So for the overall zoning map changes, the total change is 8,698 acres, or 12% of the city. And so that includes all the mixed-use zone changes as well. The up zone is, I'll just keep to the percentages, is about 21% citywide.
No, that's just what I'm interested in, is how many more units do we have? Yeah, be very, very interested, because that was a great statistic to talk about the areas, mm-hmm. but we also need to know, how much are we up for?
So I just want to, in the interest of time, I want to move us pretty quickly through this next bundle, because I want to make sure we get to the TSP and trail items.
So we just have one item within the residential grouping that we want to just to talk about.
So this is a change that is being, well, it's on, we're talking about it today because we have received testimony from a couple of property owners in the northwest, in the Southwest Sylvan Interchange area on Southwest 58th Avenue. And the comprehensive plan designation there is R2. So for these sites and for some sites to the east of them, it's R2. And staff and the PSC had recommended to retain the current R20 zoning there, specifically related to transportation infrastructure concerns. Of course, you heard testimony about their willingness to make those improvements, but staff doesn't have any other mechanism other than the process to make sure that those infrastructure pieces get put in. So staff had supported that, but this is a little more detail on where that is.
So this is a classic another bite at the apple, because the council already decided to go leave it to R20, but with the R2 designation, which lots of the people in the neighborhood disagreed with, Commissioner Saltzman made a compelling argument that it could develop, but unless we go through the zone change process, we might not have the mandate to do the transportation improvements. Is that a good summary?
Sure. That's okay. Thank you.
I'd like to ask Tom Armstrong to join us for the employment land discussion.
I had one thing I made a note about that I think might be a residential issue, and that was 7008 Southwest Capitol Hill Road, changing to R1 and R2.
That's an example where the comp plan is R7, and so we're limited. That would be reopening your comp plan mapping, because an R7 comp plan is not allowed to have R1 or R2 designate zoning. That would be a site that we would recommend. We're sympathetic to the request. It does make sense that since they're surrounded by that they go there. We'd recommend you put that on a list for us to look at by 2018, so that it's, because it would involve a comp plan amendment.
One other one I made a note of was 123 Southeast 97th, not changing it from EX.
Yeah, that is inside an area of employment zoning and employment comp plan designation that we created in order to balance the employment land supply question. So we carved out a larger area in Gateway for employment land as part of the comp plan, and this property is part of that. So you couldn't revisit that unless you want to reopen that comp plan discussion.
So an employment land designation is different from EX?
It was changed from, EX is a mixed-use zone that allows residential development, and we changed it to a different employment zone that only allows employment, and that was for the purposes of increasing employment in the Gateway area. The comp plan designation it has now would not permit us to go back on that without reopening the comp plan map question.
Okay, real quickly on employment land, there are two cases we wanted to highlight, and this is where we've applied the prime industrial overlay zone, which is sort of an extra layer of restrictions in our industrial sanctuary. It's designed to bring us, the city, in compliance with Metro's regionally significant industrial area designation. The first case is we got a letter from the Riverside Golf Club that said, hey, you guys jumped the gun a little bit by applying this prime industrial overlay before they've gone through any sort of zone change process, and they were concerned about how that might create a non-conforming use for their golf course and country club operations. And we thought that those were valid concerns, and that we actually are recommending a two-step change, and that is pull the prime overlay off of this golf course, off the Riverside golf course site, and then insert a note in the zoning code that says when they come back through to change the zone to an industrial category, the prime overlay would come with that zone change. The other case that was brought up into testimony was the industrial area out on Hayden Island, and we specifically heard from the owner up in the north corner of a small 2-acre spot that it's currently a boatyard repair facility, but wanting to expand operations to become more of a full service marina type operations, and that the prime overlay would prevent them from coming through with a zone change process through that. Again, one of the difficulties with this is the Metro's regionally significant industrial area designation, which applies to all of the area on the for this West Hayden Island industrial area. It's a little more straightforward to just do the 2-acre piece to change the to remove the prime industrial area from that. We still have to go to Metro and ask them to change their regionally significant industrial area to just plain industrial area for that.
Well, there were some others too. There was that Del Monte fresh produce situation where they were maybe just confused about the impact of the eye overlay.
We would not recommend changing the eye overlay on the Del Monte because they're kind of in the core of the heavy industrial sanctuary, and that's the intent of that overlay is to retain those kind of businesses.
So. Yeah.
And, you know, going forward, we can still look at changing the map. It just has to be a city legislative process, which is also important because it lines up with the Metro regionally significant industrial area. So that complicates the issue.
Okay.
The final map change was in the institutional category, and this was addressing a site out at the Adventist Hospital.
Right. There was one in holding at the Adventist Hospital in Gateway. The property owner came forward and wants us to apply the residential zoning to that. It seems like a reasonable request.
As opposed to CI.
Yeah. It gives them the opportunity to do apartments and household living that wouldn't be available in the CI zone.
Yeah, this is kind of like the University of Portland situation, except smaller, but same principle.
Yes.
They don't own it. It's not.
Yeah.
It
would still have the comp plan designation, so if Adventist acquired it, they could change the zone to CI and make it part of their campus.
Yeah. Is that true in UP's case as well?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, let's talk about the bikes and trails thing, because I certainly have questions about trails.
Peabot's going to join us for this conversation.
Next time.
And we'll start with the two bike classification map questions, one involving Hayden Island and the other involving 7th and 9th in Northeast.
Good morning. I'm Denver Agarda, senior planner with the Bureau of Transportation. And based on the testimony that we heard through the hearings and also subsequent discussions with your offices, we put together a few slides to kind of cover some topics that came up. The slides that we have for you today relate to sections 4 and 5 of the TSP plan, this document. And that's the bicycle classifications. And so Courtney Duke served as the portfolio manager for that section, and she'll cover those slides. 7th and 9th was one of the topics, and also Hayden Island pathway. Following that, you'll have opportunity to bring up any other TSP-related topics. You've heard already street vacations, and we've had conversations with the mayor about connectivity and centers, and so those are a couple of topics that we're prepared to talk about as well.
Courtney Duke, PBOT, and I apologize, I was out of the office yesterday, so I'm not as completely up to date as I would like to be, but Denver is here as well, so we can talk about that. So the first one we were going to talk about was Hayden Island. So the Hayden Island plan was adopted in 2009, I believe, by ordinance, And you can see, I can't see anymore. What the city council, you, and or some of you who are here, approved that plan with those designations. And then, next, we have what we recommended, right?
With
the Planning Standards Commission. And that's what the PSC recommended, which is a little bit different. So your decision is to see if you want to keep it at the what was adopted by council or what is recommended by the Planning and Sustainability Commission.
And I just want to clarify that what was adopted by council in 2009, at that time, it actually updated the TSP. So the TSP, since 2009, has shown the bike classifications on that first slide. Planning and Sustainability Commission recommended that we extend the bike classification to Hayden Bay, which is where there is an existing path.
So for the next one, or do you want to talk about that one first, or do you both of them?
I think I'm inclined to remove the easternmost bikeway segment along Hayden Bay.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah, too. I think it's not ever realistically going to happen.
All right. Thank you. Maybe it pays to be out the day before council. Things just go really easy. So then the next one is the 7th and 9th bikeways. So again, these were addressed in the bike plan of 2010 for 2030. This was by resolution as to what where we were going to put the bikeways. You guys had this conversation last time when we were talking about the projects also. And we revised the project definition to be a little bit more vague, to say that we could put it on either location. There was still quite a bit of testimony about 7th versus 9th, so we just still wanted to bring it back to you. Plus, we had heard from some staff that maybe there was some wording that people might want in to talk about how that flexibility is. You know, anytime we do a project development, when a project starts to get funded, which we do have funding for this project through the Fixing Our Streets tax, so we are starting in project development soon. You know, we have a very robust public process with the local community, as well as our modal committees, as well as any other interested parties about exactly the design of that facility and exactly where it's located. You know, anytime we have a classification in the TSP, it is a policy classification. It's saying this is what we want, and these are the types of things we want to have on these streets. But when we actually do project development, is when we discover exactly what we're going to put on the ground. So if we were to have any kind of language related to this location, we'd have to try to figure out if there was additional language we wanted on all classifications, because again, the whole city is classified with bikeways and pedestrian walkways and traffic streets that don't necessarily function that way today, but do guide us in how we're going to do the project and what it's going to look like. So did you have anything to add to that then?
Okay. Just right. A comment. The robust public process, including everybody, is what I was expecting, and I'm glad to hear that you're also expecting to do that. I think the way that the language came out was that you had made, somebody had, the decision was already
okay.
made. So we do need to be very clear that no, it hasn't.
Well, and to be clear, the Planning Commission recommended that you choose 7th and end the conversation, and so that is something that you have to clarify if you want something different than that.
So yes, I personally do, because my understanding was there was one set of residents that knew about it and testified, and not necessarily the other set. So,
not ready to end the conversation.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
So that covers the slides that we prepared. But if there are other items that you would like to bring up related to transportation, we're And yes, and we, Art Pierce, manager of policy planning and projects, is also here if there are other questions.
I'll just comment that we did receive some comments from Commissioner Fritz's office regarding the street vacation code. So we'll work with her office and Eric on those things. Was mainly related to adding some language about trees and some questions about some of the definition of temporary uses. So I've been working with Claire, and I'll work with the commissioner and Eric on any other changes we might need to put in, because I understand there's some other code work that we're going to be doing in the future that we might fold that into. So we we're working on that.
One other minor TSP thing that is moving forward is on the 16th, I believe you're going to get a presentation about the South Waterfront Street Plan Amendment from Peabod. And, they have a proposed settlement of that question, and their action on the 16th will also direct us to make the equivalent amendment in this version of the comp plan that's moving forward. And so there may be an amendment to just make sure that the change they're making gets carried into the new comp plan.
I don't want to create work for you guys. You're doing a great job. But if my colleagues have significant issues that you're discussing with them, I would hope that we would get a memo outline in it well in advance of when we make decisions, of highlighting what those issues are. And I don't need to go real deep, but that what would be helpful for me is I have periodic check-ins with my colleagues. So if Novick has five or six things and four of them are new to me, I can raise those with him, make sure I understand his concern, or have staff to staff. But so if we could open this up, so if you're getting questions or issues flagged, would you share those with us in some omnibus way so that we can all track them?
Okay. All right. Let's move on. Thank you very much. Trails next.
Yeah, the major public trails. There were a couple of questions that arose in that, and John Cole is here to help answer some of those questions. There's four or five sites that have where questions have come up. One is a change requested at the Columbia Steel site. Some discussion of trails at OHSU and Lewis and Clark, and then Dosh Park and Southwest 64th. There was also quite a bit of testimony.
So maybe let me put it this way. Could you just back up for a minute and remind us what the provenance of this trails plan was and how it got reviewed? Because it seemed to me there were a lot of folks that felt surprised by
what give
they
you
were
a
seeing,
brief.
Frankly, including me. So,
so the
what happened?
The current zoning map and comp plan has a trails map as well. And with the comp plan update, we set about doing some housekeeping on that map because under the old comp plan, parks and Peabod actually had two separate maps that weren't always in alignment. And so we tried to force alignment there. And so we did that. The comp plan adoption that went through the PSC and council last year and the year before did have this map, so there was quite a bit of discussion of that map then too. But for whatever reason, it didn't get a lot of traction or attention, and kind of went through with that process. As we got to the zoning map, that's when people start getting Measure 56 notices about the trail, and so it sort of, you know, brought the issue alive again and highlighted some of these places where there was property owner disagreement. Along the way, we also had the 40-mile loop people sort of catch on to the process and add their comments in. So it's been a little bit circuitous because we had adopted the map initially last year, but then it needs to be applied to the zoning map, and that's when it starts to where people pay attention.
I'd emphasize, Mayor, that the intent of of this effort was not to create new trail alignments per se, but rather to reflect public trail planning efforts that had gone on previously, either by the Parks Bureau of Transportation, in some instances Metro. But it was the idea that these were going to be reflected on the zoning map that created the specific public notice to individual property owners that caught people's attention.
And just to be clear about what the zoning map means, it what happens with these trail alignments is they show up as little stars on the zoning map in a line, and if you're in development review, the presence of those stars on the zoning map doesn't mean anything for you in terms of ongoing use of your property. It doesn't give an easement or give us a right to build a trail. What it does is trigger a conversation with substantial redevelopment.
Based on the testimony that you heard, and that you've got some slides here, some of those, are you recommending changing some of these?
The one at the beginning, the Columbia Steel site, we've talked to that property owner and they're recommending that change. It's a logical refinement based on their operations needs. The OHSU and Lewis and Clark questions, both of those revolve around sort of what is the nature of a public trail on a college campus, and I think there's a legal question that we're exploring about related to public safety. If a college campus has an exclusion process, for example, based for a safety reason with an individual, does the trail designation get in the way of that in some way if we have a public easement that crosses their property? And so we have some questions to the city attorney about what that means to try and answer those.
It's my understanding that a trail designation does not create an easement. As you said, correct. It sort of triggers a conversation.
Correct, although colleges are in the development business often, so at some point with both of those colleges, that trail question will probably get triggered. And so with OHSU, there's an added layer that as part of the Southwest Corridor project, we are considering an enhanced pedestrian connection here, so it's possible that will get built. But I think their concern about they're not opposed to the idea of a pedestrian connection here. I think they're raising legal questions about what that might mean for their operations and can they exclude people from that.
Well, this sounds like some of the work we've done in the past on the 4T. And my recollection is we have a lot of issues as well. If it's public or privately owned, liability issues, who maintains it, who has a legal responsibility to maintain it. There's a whole host of issues. And so when you say that the property owner is raising legal issues, I would think we have a number of legal issues, particularly if it's passing through private property. So how are we vetting those issues?
Yeah, well, I mean, the trails issue as a whole is fraught with a lot of legal history, and as you probably all know, and so we've been working closely with the city attorney on this whole process. And this particular issue from the college campus is, well, we don't have a recommendation about what to do with that testimony yet because we need a little more discussion with the city attorney, I think.
Commissioner, as a general rule for trails, however, if a property owner does designate an easement to the city and the city accepts it, and if a trail is built to city standards, then the city agrees to maintenance of that particular trail segment and agrees to liability for what happens on that trail.
Okay, so tell us about the other two, the Dosh Park and the Southwest 64.
So both of those are situations where you got quite a bit of testimony from the homeowners in the area. It's both situations are low-density residential areas where in the case of Dosh Park, it's a through private street, which is unusual. Because we don't allow that anymore, but this got in before that requirement. And then in 64th, there was an issue with just how realistic that would be. Since it's at the city's edge, we don't control where the trail goes beyond our boundary. So I think there was a question about whether that would just be a dead-end spur or not.
Eric, I'd like to make one additional comment on the OHSU campus trail alignment. And we did get correspondence from the institution that they prefer not to have a stars on the map line across their campus at this point in time. But if they were to have one, they would prefer it follow that green, more circuitous loop that aligns with the street and the sidewalks rather than the orange line that kind of goes up a set of stairs behind some parking structures. And we also got a letter of testimony from the Neighborhood Association, from the Homestead Neighborhood Association, that they would prefer the shorter orange alignment, but that if push came to shove, they could agree to the longer green loop as well.
And I would say I think that it doesn't matter because the tool of the stars on the map is not an alignment specific tool. It doesn't prejudice the final location of the map within a particular property. So in either location, we're going to have a conversation where all options are open about how you get across that property with a trail that generally goes from point A to point B. So I think we shouldn't probably get hung up in where exactly the line is because the form of this tool just doesn't that doesn't matter.
And I would agree that with the campuses are often doing developments, so therefore it's worth having the stars on them. The Dush Park in 64th, and there's another one in Forest Park, I mean Forest Heights Neighborhood Association, that kind of dead ends into private property. I don't see that there's ever going to be complete redevelopment of that area.
On the one in Forest Heights, there was testimony and information in that about the... it's caught up in a further discussion of in Washington County, beyond our boundary, there is a trail plan that would connect to it.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. I didn't mean Forest Heights, I meant Forest Park. The Forest Park Neighborhood Association is one there. So
yeah,
is that one you're talking about?
That's the one I'm talking about. Yeah, it's on near Saltzman Road, and it currently goes to a dead end that's at the city boundary, but there is the reason it goes there is there's a longer term connection that goes through Washington County beyond that.
But the Neighborhood Association was saying that it's on private, it goes through private property.
It does, but many of these trails do, and that's the nature of the tool, is that it's a zoning tool that we use to obtain, where it's legal to obtain an easement for a trail.
Well, obviously I'd like this one on the list of things to consider. Thank you.
You know, without going too deep into this, the three bureaus that have a dog in this are BES, PBOT, and Parks. And depending on the alignment, what happens is people come to BES and say, deal with the stormwater runoff issue. And that may or may not be in the queue. PBOT has an issue. Parks has a, you know, if we're going to maintain the trail issue. So I guess I could use a little more information on what legal issues and practical issues have been raised, particularly on the campuses.
With regard to 64th and Dush Park Lane, both of those are situations where you have a private right-of-way, I believe, that where there's not likely to be significant redevelopment. So it may be a question about how practical the trail is going to be to actually achieve there, short of us just buying the easement outright. But so what we'd need to figure out in both those cases is there an alternate alignment that's more practical?
Good idea, because I think just like the Hayden Island thing, it's just not going to happen in a situation with Dush Park, where it's not going to happen. It's a private street. We're not going to take possession of that street. The log jam's never going to break. So unless there are other questions about amendments, I was going to say we ought to do a quick process check here, because this refresher and review has hopefully helped us remember issues that we want to bear down on in amendments, and you need to hear from us by the end of this week with Sam, correct?
Yeah, so a reminder of the process check is we would like your list of amendments this week, if that's possible. We're going to use that to send a courtesy notice to the map-related property owners for the amendments related to the map. The following week, so next Friday, we would try and publish a list which would include the code changes. So for code-related amendments, we'll work with your offices to finalize the language. If there isn't any, we can help with that. And for the map, we'll just verify the exact sites that are the subject, and we want to make sure we know what you're proposing from and to. So we'll get that out publicly by the end of next week, we hope. And that would give us a couple weeks' notice before the 17th. And we do have
Commissioner Fish's question, when do we get the list of what each of the other commissioners, I know we have a partial list now.
They have that list already, actually. Okay. Your staff has access to a shared list that we've circulated, so we'll make sure that you get that.
So where the presentation has identified multiple options for dealing with a particular issue, how are you going to translate those into amendments? What's your default position if the council is not clear?
If we will, in some cases, there are two commissioners with different perspectives, and they will both offer their amendments, and we'll have that conversation. In a case where there's not that situation, we will probably make a recommendation to the mayor's office, and they will carry that.
So let me take the one that we spent some time talking about, drive-through facilities, and I have to study this, and I have to get back into my boot camp mode. But you've proposed an option C,
right,
which the mayor seems to have said some nice things about. That sounds like maybe a hybrid compromise. So
it's likely that that will be thrown into the mix as either the mayor's amendment or the or staff a staff proposal, so it's before us?
We're not going to do it. We're going to have one of you bring up the amendments. If you don't bring it up,
bring
then
that
we're...
Bring forward as amendment. So,
if you have some third way that you're proposing, then as a general matter, unless the mayor finds them deeply offensive, he'll offer them as a mayor amendment so that they're on the table for our discussion. Is that right, John?
Yeah. Trying to get to as close to consensus with those as we can before we start the process, but we may have, we'll have some divided votes over some of these things. That's fine.
And there will be a small bundle of staff-generated technical amendments that, that we'll bundle together for a single vote, but they're not to the anywhere near the level of controversy of the drive-through question.
Any other requests, either from the Bureau to us or from us to the Bureau, other than take care of yourself, Eric? get rid of that cold.
I will hold on water.
It's good for you.
I will be checking in with each of your offices to verify where you are with your thinking on these different amendments. And, you know, we presented today the information on the topics that that largely you had raised questions of us already, so that's how we came up with the list today. But if there are others that we didn't talk about, please, you know, let us know and we can try and dig into those.
We're also giving these to the other, like to Parks and BES, their directors, so that they're already aware, but I want to make sure that each one of these things where they may have an involvement, like the trails, that they know that there's some amendment on the table.
I appreciate that because we have a lot on our agenda, our calendar right now, so... there's a lot. Thank you.